Those little gizmos you see people wearing on their wrists to track their fitness, Wall Street just loves them. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, the 18th of June. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Bearing in mind my now standard caveat that the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy and the economy is not the Dow. The ticker symbol of today is FIT, Fitbit Incorporated, which went public this morning to a festive, shall we say, reception from traders. It's been quite the year for public offerings, tech offerings in particular. James Park is the co-founder and CEO of what is, or what was today anyway, Wall Street's favorite newcomer. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Why'd you decide to go public now?
You know, we're at a scale of revenue and profitability that we felt it made a lot of sense. There's a lot of great things that we can do with the capital that we raised from the IPO. There's a lot of advanced research and development that we can do on our products, ranging from more hardware to more incredible software to make people healthier.
There are companies out there, many of them from overseas, who are making the devices that you guys make, but they're doing it more cheaply and they're attacking you on price. Are you in a vulnerable spot between the Apple Watch and these cheaper imitations?
One, it's a very huge market that we're all participating in. Consumers spend over $200 billion on health and fitness products and services, so we're all chasing a very massive opportunity. And for the low-cost competitors, it really takes a lot of research and development dollars to develop and deliver very innovative and easy-to-use products for consumers. We've doubled R&D spend year over year. This year, as a company, we're actually tripling R&D spend to over $150 million.
What are you going to do with all the money, though, that you get from the IPO other than R&D?
We started investing in pretty significant sales and marketing campaigns. Fitbit is pretty much already synonymous with health and fitness tracking. We're almost a Kleenex of the category. But really, even in the U.S., consumer awareness and penetration rates of devices like the Fitbit are still pretty low. So we'll be running TV campaigns, print campaigns, et cetera, to really accelerate awareness of our brand.
I don't have the stock charts in front of me, and I apologize for that, but you had a pretty good pop at the open today when you guys went public. The NASDAQ has been at record highs today. I mean, even all-time record highs, including the boom. So I have two words for you. Tech bubble. What do you think?
You know, I'm kind of agnostic as to whether there is a tech bubble for Fitbit as a company.
Well, you want one, right? Because you now are in the middle of it.
Well, aside from whether there's a tech bubble as a company, we generate a lot of revenue. We have over a 246% CAGR over the past few years.
246% what?
CAGR, compounded annual growth rate.
Thank you.
So
thank you
very
much.
Increased 2x to 5x in revenue year over year historically, and we're very profitable as well, even on a GAAP basis, which is pretty rare for a tech IPO.
Generally accepted accounting principles there,
yes.
if we could de-jargonize that for a minute. Let's say, just for argument's sake, that Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, who's got, I think, $190 billion in the bank, comes to you and says, I'll give you, James, $2 billion for your company. What do you say?
You know, we've really never been focused on exits as a company. Really, the key to our success has been being really heads down and focusing on growing the business over the years.
That was kind of an interesting pregnant pause after the though.
We're focused on business.
James Park, he's the founder, co-founder rather, and CEO of Fitbit. Went public today. Ticker symbol is a good one, FIT. Mr. Park, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Pope Francis released his much-anticipated encyclical on climate change today. He sided firmly with those who believe global warming is caused by human activities, and he was firmly critical of two of those activities, capitalism and consumerism. The quest for too much profit and for too much stuff, the Pope wrote, hurts the planet, thus staking out territory most economists make a point of avoiding, a moral interpretation of the economy. Marketplace's Adam Allington has that story.
This isn't the first time a major faith has put forth a moral interpretation of economic prosperity. Even within the Catholic Church, popes going all the way back to Leo XIII and the Industrial Revolution have used the encyclical to push back against the market. Thomas Rees is a Jesuit priest and senior analyst at the National Catholic Reporter.
Consistently, the popes have spoken that the marketplace is not God. It is not going to solve all of our problems.
Reese says economists tend to view their subject as value-free, a matter of the efficient allocation of scarce resources, but that the Pope feels this approach isn't addressing the needs of the poorest and weakest among us.
The realm that he deals with, the morality of life, is one that economics has struggled with. I think economics is beginning to rethink a little bit.
Maureen O'Hara is a professor of finance at Cornell University. In talking about issues like climate change and the environment in terms of values, the Pope is entering territory many economists tend to avoid.
The closest we tend to get is things are inefficient. And I think many people kind of feel that that may not tell the full story. And that's where I think the Pope is trying to blend both the pieces from the economics perspective and the moral perspective together.
O'Hara says she agrees with much of what the Pope said, but not his opposition to trading carbon credits. Cap and trade, she said, can be an effective tool for reducing pollution. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Traders love them some Fitbit and pretty much everything else they could get their hands on today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know you've heard me say this before, and this time I'm pretty sure I really mean it. Push is rapidly coming to shove between Greece and those to whom it owes a whole lot of money. The next big deadline is the end of this month. Meetings are being held right and left to see if there is a way to keep Greece in the Eurozone. But what about the Greeks themselves, the ones getting squeezed by austerity budgets for 5 years and dealing with a 25% unemployment rate? 25%. Let me say that again. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Athens today. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
What's the mood then on the streets? Do they favor the government and its defiance, or are they sick and tired of this whole thing?
Well, both, really. I mean, most certainly do back the government. They see the government as standing up for Greece, for standing up to these foreigners who are trying to push them around. But mostly, as you suggest, weariness is the mood. People are pretty fed up. Christos Mavrou, who's the manager of a furniture retailing firm, told me that the Greeks are sick of all the last-ditch meetings, the crisis talks, the deadlines, living up to the next critical moment.
Till the end of February, till the end of March, till the end of April, till the end of June. So we are tired of the critical moments. We are tired of this. We can't stand it anymore.
Yeah, till the end of February, the end of March, the end of June. So here we are. But membership in the Euro, though, Stephen, is very popular, right? So they want this to be over, but they don't want to be out of the Euro.
That's absolutely right. According to the poll, something like 79% want to stay with the euro, even though it has, many would argue, caused them a great deal of misery.
I saw on TV the other night soup kitchens and soup lines. What evidence of hardship do you see on the actual streets of Athens?
Well, in central Athens, not much evidence at all. I mean, you do see lots of boarded up shops. It's a pretty shabby down at heel city, no doubt about it. But it doesn't feel like a city in crisis. However, Nick Voglis, who runs a small sandwich bar here, says don't be fooled by the relatively relaxed atmosphere. If the European Central Bank pulls the plug and there's a major run on the banks, it'll turn very ugly here fast.
If one person in Greece right now goes to an ATM and tries to remove money and the money doesn't come out, this place will go on fire. It will explode. There's no doubt about that.
Are people lining up the banks? Has there been a bank run or no?
A very long, slow one. The central bank yesterday revealed that something like 30 billion euros, $33 billion has been withdrawn from the Greek banking system since October. Wealthy people have been taking their money out and putting it overseas. The less well-heeled have been taking it out and stuffing it in their mattresses. Mm. So there must be some pretty lumpy mattresses in this country at the moment.
Spitball this for me then, Stephen. If you went out on the street right now and asked 10 people how this was going to end, what would the majority say?
Well, I haven't met anyone yet that really believes the country's going to default and crash out of the euro. all the people that I've spoken to think that the government's going to blink at the 11th hour. It'll sign the bailout deal and the country will stumble on until the next crisis. But there is nevertheless always that lurking suspicion, that lurking fear of a miscalculation, of a mistake, of a Grexit by accident, or as they're calling it now, Grexit.
Grexit, yeah, I saw that the other day. Stephen Beard in Athens for us. Future stories coming from Stephen on the air next week. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
I am, as I believe I've said before, a big space guy. Apollo, Gemini, the whole deal, especially from the early days. Which is why when I heard that ABC is turning Lily Capel's book, The Astronaut Wives Club, into a miniseries, I was pretty much in. It's the story of the women behind the men of NASA's Mercury program, the original seven astronauts. And just as their husbands were chosen, so too were the wives chosen in the space race against the Russians, except in a different kind of way.
Sounds like we're propaganda.
Now, who's to say that putting your best foot forward wouldn't be a real factor in your husband's success? Besides, it's not like you ladies have a lot of bad habits or big secrets.
Of course not. We're just a bunch of housewives.
Or, actually, so much more, really. Stephanie Savage brought the book to the small screen. She's probably best known for her work on other television shows starring women, Gossip Girl for one, and before that, The OC. I went out to her office at Disney the other day and started with why this topic and why this book.
I think it was the combination of the excitement of the period and the space program, and then it was an opportunity to tell that story through a completely different perspective, which was the point of view of the wives.
The thing about Astronaut Wives, though, is that you're writing about real people. That's got to be a challenge. Real people, some of whom are still alive. Hello. Mm-hmm. Challenging?
Definitely challenging. I mean, I feel like we have a real responsibility to tell something that is truthful to these people's, you know, points of view and who they were. At the same time, we've got to fit it into 10 episodes. So you're trying to find a balance between something that is historically accurate as possible, but also is going to be entertaining to an audience. You also have a second challenge when you're doing something that's based on women's history, which is a lot of this stuff is not written down or recorded anywhere.
So how did you do it? That's actually a great point.
I think the work that Lily Capel did in her book is really important because she did a real oral history. She went out to all of these women's homes all across the country, sat in their kitchens, and took down their stories. So we mostly worked from the book, and I read a lot of the transcripts, especially for Betty and Reen and Joe, who are our seven wives who are still, who Joe passed away very recently, but who were still alive at the time.
Did you meet the wives?
I had the good fortune of meeting Betty Grissom, just this last spring.
And what was that like?
It was amazing. She's a real tough cookie. She doesn't hold anything back. She reminds me a lot of my mom in that way. A very straight shooter.
Yeah, we should remind folks how her husband died in the fire in Apollo 1 in January 67.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, well, that's, you know. Well, so that's actually a really good question. People know what's going to happen. How do you write that in a way that makes people want to come back next week?
I think some people know what's going to happen. I actually think a lot of people don't. And nothing would make me happier as if people got curious enough to actually go online and start looking and researching the Apollo 1 fire and like what happened and who died and who was responsible. And that would be amazing to me if people would actually, you know, go to the trouble to figure that stuff out.
Do you worry at all about getting typecast is the wrong word, but pigeonholed, I guess, into this woman who does women's issue stories?
No, because I actually think that even doing this, coming from Gossip Girl, is a pretty big shift. In my mind, Gossip Girls is a story about that's the foundation is female friendship and that it explores a lot of things that weren't getting serviced on television at all. But I think in the popular consciousness, that's not really what it was about. So doing something like this that's a little bit more grown up, a little bit more overtly in the world of gender dynamics is a big shift. And I know even some of the wives when they heard that I was going to be the person writing the series, had some misgivings because their sense was, oh, if it's the woman from Gossip Girl, it's going to be like Gossip Girl.
You clearly had a very clear concept of this miniseries, right? You had a beginning and an end and all this stuff in the middle. Are you going to do that again for other subject matter? Or I guess maybe you'll wait and see.
I'd love to do something like this again. I mean, ABC was sort of asking us, well, what, you know, they would love to have this be something that could go on for many seasons. But there are so many amazing untold women stories that I'd be happy to do one of these every summer for the rest of my life. There's just so many stories that haven't been told.
Stephanie Savage, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Astronaut Wives Club premieres tonight on ABC local listings, as they say. Coming up,
an experienced electrical engineer, field operator, once said to me, the whole system is going to fall down someday. It's just not going to happen on the same day.
Great. Just great. More from our infrastructure series straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. There it is, the really happy music. I was kind of banking on that. Didn't want to say anything, though. The Dow Industrial is up 180 points, 1%, closed at 18,115 today. The NASDAQ jumped 68 points, 1.3%, 51.32. The S&P 500 added 20 points, 1%, finished at 21.21. Time was your electric utility was named for where you live. Connecticut Light and Power, Public Service of New Jersey, anybody? Now, multi-state conglomerates is where we are. Big utilities rose with the markets today. Exelon, the biggest operator of nuclear generators, up 0.2% today. NextEra Energy, number one in wind and solar, up 1.5%. Oracle's quarterly earnings came in low and shares fell nearly 5%. Bond prices fell as well. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.32%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The U.S. Conference of Mayors 83rd Annual Meeting convenes in San Francisco. President Obama is scheduled to speak. In Oakland, California, a parade and rally take place in celebration of NBA champs, the Golden State Warriors. And hey there, what's your hurry? Tomorrow is World Songturing Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. So far this week on our series, The Weak Link, about America's infrastructure and the problems with it, we've done roads and water. Today, electricity. One top engineering organization has given our power grid a D plus for the power plant, utility poles, and electric wires that all of us depend on pretty much every single day. So you want to talk weak link? There it is, a system vulnerable to vandalism, the occasional squirrel, but most of all, weather. From the Sustainability Desk, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
If you talk to pros in the electricity business, you come across two jokes. Here's number one. If you lose your internet, you're back in 1979. Lose your power, and you're back in 1879. So what's that like? I asked around and was told to visit Connecticut. Yeah, Connecticut. Three historic storms hit the state in 2011 and 2012. And each time, more than 600,000 residents lost power for days. More than lights went out. Water comes from wells in the town of Marlborough. Cliff Dennis lives there.
The well runs off electricity, and when you lose power, you don't have the pump working to push the water into the house, and you only get about two flushes out of the toilets, and that's what you get. And when you're out for a week, it can get pretty tough.
Marlborough went dark for a week in all three storms. Cliff Dennis's wife, Dorothy, now fills the tub with water when she senses a big one coming. Still,
is a tub of water enough?
You don't flush every time, trust me.
Town gas stations lost power to pump their gas. Cell phone batteries died. And perishable food perished, unless you ate it.
Oh, I had filet mignon all week. I just bought a brand new one, had it chopped up into steaks. It was in the freezer. We lost the power. I said, we have to eat this.
In the average year, a person in New England loses power for a total of 3.5 hours. That's compared to 4 minutes in Japan. The U.S. fares worse than any other rich country. And the cost in lost work and production is estimated at $80 billion. That's more than Google makes in a year. Now, the big culprit is weather. Say winds knocking tree limbs into local power lines. So in Marlboro, backup generators sell rather well, says remodeling contractor Scott Welch. To him, the power grid is no longer good enough.
We're still consuming electricity in ways that we've done for over 100 years in this country. I think what we're doing is antiquated.
Which cues up joke number two. If Thomas Edison came back to life today, he would recognize the power grid he helped invent. Which, when you step back and think about it, was remarkable. So let's bring his voice back for a moment.
When I looked around at the resources of the electric...
For some quick history. In 1879, Edison brought us the commercial light bulb. And 3 years later, he built the first electric utility system. Richard Hirsch is an energy historian at Virginia Tech.
He invented a light bulb. He also invented specialized generators to produce electricity. He developed the wiring system.
Edison's very first utility went up in Manhattan. Like a local drugstore, it was a local electric company, with generators and customers all in the same place. But this local model lost out. Two of Edison's rivals, Nikola Tesla and George Westinghouse, developed long-distance transmission to send power from big sources far away.
Westinghouse transmitted power from a Niagara Falls hydropower plant to the city of Buffalo, about 20 miles distant.
Long-distance electricity was more efficient and cheaper, so America ended up with a hub-and-spoke system of poles and wires. And electricity changed everything.
It allows you to heat, to cool, to illuminate. In factories, it boosted productivity hugely. In homes, it enables people to do things at day and night in ways that people in the 19th century could only imagine.
What a thrill to be so free when you live better electrically.
In the 1950s, General Electric and the Westinghouse Company sponsored a commercial campaign. Use ovens, fridges, washers and dryers, and vacuum cleaners. And we did. But then the grid aged, and investment didn't keep up. Outages have tripled since the 1980s. Longtime utility executive Larry Riley is with Rosewood Consulting.
An experienced electrical engineer, field operator, once said to me, the whole system is going to fall down someday. It's just not going to happen on the same day. That was really the philosophy of operating companies for a long time, is to wait till failure.
He says the electricity infrastructure went up in a big hurry.
People were looking for the fastest, cheapest places to put facilities. If we went back and had the ability to do it again, the system would have been designed a little bit differently, but of course we don't have that opportunity.
Case in point, a 1920s substation in the Connecticut town of Branford on Long Island Sound. It was built right at sea level, so it floods and fails with storm surges. Marcia Chambers is a local resident and journalist.
I don't know what was in the minds of folks as to why it went here. The flooding of the street has long been an issue.
In two of the big storms, Irene and Sandy, one of Branford's main internet providers, Comcast, lost its own power, gone with the whole Comcast bundle. Internet, TV, phone.
The idea that companies are bundling everything and giving you a discount sounds really terrific, doesn't it? Except when it goes down.
Local cell towers also lost power. The town hospice saw its backup generator fail, so it had to evacuate dying people. Why did so much of the grid go down? Yale Law Professor Dan Esty was state energy commissioner for all three storms.
And we found in Connecticut that half the utility poles were more than 50 years old, did not meet modern standards. When faced with heavy wind, began to snap. A significant percent of the wires were not insulated, meaning that not only if they were knocked down was their problem, but if a tree branch touched them, they would arc and short out.
Esty blamed state rules aimed at keeping customer rates low. That discouraged utilities from investing in reliability, he says.
We have an antiquated regulatory model that provided limited capital and resulted, I think, in systematic underinvestment in grid modernization.
By the third storm, state lawmakers had enough. They started to consider big changes to the power grid. And Dan Estes' wife, she had enough too, by Superstorm Sandy.
You know, I came home after the first night in the bunker with the governor, and on the second night did grill on my outside grill and served my wife dinner by candlelight, and I think it was quite charming. On the third day, she was grumbling a bit, and on the fourth day, she asked me, who the hell is the Commissioner of Energy in the state of Connecticut?
The state invested in a new technology from the past, small local power grids going back to Edison circa 1882, and more on that tomorrow. In Branford, Connecticut, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Before tomorrow, though, if you want to see how the power grid works, we can do that for you. Check out the video we've got at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, Tesla has now come to the middle class. Mattel is out with a Hot Wheels version of the Tesla Model S. To be specific, it's a P85D. You can get the 1/64th scale model for $1.09, red or silver. The Hot Wheels Tesla Roadster, by the way, the first one in the series, is of course now a collector's item that will cost you 50 American dollars. Alrighty, we are out of here. The Dow up 180 points today, 1%. The NASDAQ up 68 points, 1.33%. The S&P 500 added 20 points, 1% on the nose. Golda Arthur, Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.